good afternoon. You were tuned to XL Radio with Baby Zan. Here for our 11th episode. If this is your first time tuning in, first of all, welcome. XL Radio is a weekly podcast celebrating diversity and cultural heritage in music. Every week we talk to a different artist from around the world about their experience and practices. And this week I've had the pleasure of talking with Camille El Feghali. The music of which you are currently listening to with his project Tara Beat. We're going to be talking today about Camille's work with the Classical Arabic Music Archiving and Research Center in Beirut. But to start off, let's sink our teeth into this song. This one is called Reggae Rust. Thank you.
Can you hear me clearly?
Oh, it's so clear. Are you using a microphone?
Yeah, I am.
So good!
All I wanted my other... to get in the radio mood, kind of.
Yeah, all my other calls have been very crackly. This is very nice to hear. And Joe told me that you're working in music restoration with Arab music?
Yeah, I was, actually, before I moved to Australia.
Awesome. Can I ask you about what, yeah, your experience with that and how that started for you?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you a little background first.
Please.
Of, like, culture in Lebanon in general.
Yeah.
If you want, like, in the last 10 years, people have been a bit ignoring their heritage a bit. And because we've been following a very Americanized, Westernized system, so people started having this idea of, like, everything related to Middle Eastern culture is a bit shameful or negative in a way. So, like, let's say our parents' generations always did their best to appear as Western as they can. Also, it's a mentality that has to do with the fact that we were colonized in the past, and that's how, like, colonizing powers did to a bit control the population and make it into their, like, make people sympathize with them, kind of.
Mm.
Well, now the younger generation is really getting interested again into their heritage. Yeah, and that's why, like, many people now are deciding, like, instead of learning, let's say, guitar or piano in Lebanon, they're going back to the traditional instruments and the traditional, like, music theory in general, like, all the different practices and stuff. And yeah, and there are lots of movements now. Like, some people are getting into, like, really pure classical Arabic music that has been distorted a lot since the 50s because of all this Western influence. So people are going back to how it was before the 30s, kind of. And you have people, for example, like myself, I chose to mix various styles of electronic music using Arabic music, like theory and instruments. And I learned a lot, like, a lot of this information by working at this archive, because what's crazy is the government of Lebanon doesn't really care about culture that much. So it was a private foundation, and, like, it was a man who was passionate about music that made quite a bit of money in his life, and he's he managed to get a huge collection of old discs. The main focus was all the recordings before the 40s 50s, because after that there was a movement that kind of distorted its real complexity and richness, quite a bit like similarly to the West, for example, when, you know, jazz got taken over by jazzish pop in a way. It's it's a bit similar in some way. So yeah, we used to record back then, like, at the archive, we mainly focused on 78 RPM discs, which is, like, one of the oldest mediums of recording audio. Mm. And what's so special about this medium is because Arabic music is an oral tradition. So compositions are not written down, but taught over generations. And recording really revolutionized this, because people could listen to themselves for the first time. So it kind of created a certain boom. And especially, like, the beginning of the 20th century, that's what we call the Arabic music renaissance. And that's what the archive really focuses on, especially. And what's said about all of this is what came later, kind of because of political reasons, tried to erase all this evidence, because it was something that was it was like common culture that was uniting all the Middle Eastern different countries. When the nationalist movement happened in the Middle East, people tried to hide this unity to further develop all those separations. And which is why, like, unfortunately now, you know, people all over the Middle East can be sometimes a bit nationalistic with their culture, with their idols, with their music. And that's something that the archive was kind of working against in some way.
Did you find, because I know that there was definitely a few movements banning a lot of music in Lebanon for political reasons. Is that something that you found with the archive, or because it was stuff before the 30s that wasn't so much of an issue?
No, it wasn't an issue, and, like, there wasn't as much opposition to it. It's just, like, you know, because like governments have been trying to hide this for generations. So now, like, no one knows about it. Like, even when you ask people, like, a common, for example, like anyone here, let's say in Australia, you ask them who's Mozart, they would know who's Mozart. Mm. While people in the Middle East don't know anything about their heritage because it was hidden from them, unfortunately. And all the artists that we know are like the ones that came after the 50s, after like countries were created. Well, I think most of the things that get banned today, it's more because of social issues rather than political issues. It's because of more like some movements are seen as being maybe like satanist or immoral, for example. Like there was a big event, it was a bit like ridiculous. 2 years ago, there was a local band that's one of the most famous one in Lebanon. They're called Masroor Leila. They were banned from performing in Lebanon because they were openly gay. And that was something that really made the big, like a big shock. And it's not the only reason of them being gay, but they also had like some songs that criticized religion. And, you know, even though like the younger generation is much more open in Lebanon, it's still in a way dominated by people that have a bit more conservative beliefs, I think.
So when the government is banning particular music or kind of hiding from the public their own cultural heritage, is this often when they consider it to be inflammatory in terms of like religion or political ideologies?
Yeah, I think like nowadays it's again, but that's mostly in rock and pop. And like it's more, let's say, imported styles rather than, like, in the archives case, it's a bit different. It's like it's a more hidden issue. You know, it's not affecting everyone, but it's just that, you know, for me, it's just people got their culture ripped off from them. That even it's not, it's like, you know, after wars, how people delete history books or burn like libraries and like. There are many examples of that in history, and what's striking in the Middle East is that this is very recent. Like it's like the two world wars. That's something we don't talk about, but it's mainly something that happened in the two world wars, where like even those discs were kind of melted to produce weapons, like by Germany and other countries. You know, which is sad, and because it's something a bit old, we can't really like people don't identify with it. It's not like the same. Reaction impact that we get when now we're banning music that people like. It's like, for me, it's, you know, part of the like history and the heritage of the people.
Thank you. Like with the archiving of this music, are you trying to republish it back to Lebanon? How have you found trying to get the music back onto a platform for people to hear?
So the main goal was to make it digital, like turn those discs into a digital medium to make it, of course, more accessible for people. And again, like, as I mentioned to you, much more people are now interested in discovering their culture. Mm-hmm. So, so we've been receiving emails and like people have been very positively responsive with it. And also the archive was responsible, like was also working as an event creating, like promoting events and even creating podcasts that would discuss about certain historical events and stuff to make it more accessible for people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing our best. It's just the fact that it's a private organization, it kept us a bit limited. Like the crew was small. We did our best though, and like of course we did. We did change many things, and it's always so satisfying when there's only one single copy of a recording and that we managed to like record. You know, like it's such a good feeling that, you know, like if not for what we did, this recording would have, like, that's sometimes more than 100 years old, would have been just, it would just have vanished.
It's like music archaeology.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. And it's so fascinating, really. Like, especially if you're into history and, like, politics or sociology, it's really, like, so, like, I learned so much about my own culture by working there.
Yeah, so how did you find these records?
Actually, it's quite funny, like, from different sources. Most of them are from Egypt, actually, because the Arabic Renaissance was mainly in Egypt. That's where it started, at least. It's like, when we think of the Western Renaissance, we think of, like, Italy. It was a bit Egypt for the Middle East. But sadly, again, like, it's, like, many people don't know the value of this. Like, sometimes we find some records in, like, in a flea market, in, like, a souk. And, you know, they use it as a coffee stand. Like, sometimes we had to clean some discs and they had, like, coffee marks that we had to, like, remove. Yeah. And many times, you know, for example, we got a lot of tapes from after the Iraqi war in 2003 that were being sold on the street, like, just by vendors. And again, like, what's absurd is, like, it's such a rare, rare content on it that, you know, it's sad sometimes when, like, we receive a disc and there aren't many copies of it left. And it's like it has been used as a table or something. But it's, again, it's nice to save it. But some of them, like, there are a few as well, like, few disc, like, people who sell discs. And they're a bit, it's a bit complicated to buy from them as well, because they know how much we need the discs, so they would sometimes give us very bad prices for rare ones. It was a bit of everywhere. And some of the mediums we had are even recordings by, especially when tape came out, like older recordings after the 50s, where many of them were musicologists that were going, like, traveling around the Middle East and recording many folk, music from villages and stuff like that.
Mm.
And that was really interesting as well, because, like, there are some genres, that are very specific. Like, for example, one of the weirdest one was, was the Bahraini. In Bahrain, there's a specific music for sailors. And it's really weird. Like, when you listen to it, you feel it's like, it comes from a, I don't know, it comes from a movie or something. Because it doesn't, like, for us, it's weird to perceive it as music, but it's a tradition they've been doing for many years. And they're influenced by all the countries they travel to. And yeah, it's like, it's such a rich culture at the end.
That track we heard before was another one from Tara Beat called Jagabam. And we're now going to dip our ears into another track, Raving Darwich.
Thank you.
how do you find the process from getting your hands on a physical recording to then kind of doing all of the investigative back work to finding out about like the history of who performed it?
We were three employees at this archive at the time. Now it might have changed a bit. But two of us were doing like the sound engineering, and there was one person doing all the documentation. So first of all, like, we would receive a series of discs and tapes that we would clean. We would clean using a ultrasound machine, because there are some parts of petrified dust that are that would stick on the disc, and it's only with ultrasound that you can remove them. And you know, and we had like special, and some of them were a bit dirtier than others, so we had to physically remove them. Even sometimes they're broken in half, we need to fix them and use a specific glue to get the needle running without it stopping. And after we start recording that, so we record it with, as like, we, there's a setting called flat, which is as it is, but we had a few different preamps that made the some discs clearer, depending on the company that manufactured it. So we recorded like a few times like that to have like different copies, because sometimes also the needles run, like the speed changes a bit while we're playing it, and so on. And like while we're doing this as the audio team, yeah, the person like in charge of documentation would note down who are the musicians playing, what year was it played, and what are the, because sometimes like the same artists have different recordings of same melodies. So we would write the comments, like, for example, violin sounded higher than flute, for example, etc. And and back to the sound team, we used to also filter the sounds to make all the pops that came from needles, all the pops and like the little glitches in the recordings, we would fix it while, of course, not doing it too much, because there's a certain character to all this that we try to preserve as well. And we would release them, like usually every year we would release a book talking about a certain artist and release like four discs of like the best recordings by this certain artist. And the book would talk about his life or her life, or also like what this person innovated in terms of Arabic music, and why is this person so special, etc. There are quite a few different, it's like, it's interesting, you know, and some people are quite interested in reading all those information about those artists. And again, like, what's fascinating is those recordings were recorded recently for the first time, even though they're like more than, some of them more than 100 years old. Like the first recording we have was from 1895.
Yeah. Wow. Mm. Did you find there was quite a good reception to the public about re-seeing these very old Arabic classical pieces?
Yeah, of course. I mean, some people, it was mainly well received among like music fans, people who are interested in history, music, or even like like sociology. People who are interested in Arabic identity, because you know it's ongoing quite a little. Like the Middle East now is not in a very stable state. And there are so many ideologies all the time. Like some people turned to being more, like, especially in the last 20 years, you know, some people became more religiously fanatic. Some people became ultra, like, liberal, where, you know, in a way, like, unfortunately, rejecting everything related to our culture because of, like, it's something against all this religious fanatism. But, you know, you have people who are still moderate that would appreciate, like, knowing more about our culture because it's a more accurate representation of our past and who we are. But many people, you know, like, when we were raised listening to songs since we're kids, it's hard now to come and say, like, oh, this is your heritage. You're like, no, I know my heritage. Some people can be a bit indifferent about it as well, which is, I would say, like, the majority of people. Because, again, in the Middle East, it's about, many times, it's about having opinions rather than seeking for the truth. It's like you pick a side in a way. It's hard to describe it. Like, I think we should go there to really experience it.
Yeah. So did you grow up or have parts of your life in Lebanon?
Yeah, actually, I lived most of my life in Lebanon. Yeah, I had a French education actually there, because there are many schools that teach French as the main language. That's why some people tell me I have quite a French accent. I think that's why, maybe.
It does sound quite French.
Yeah, but I mean, my teachers were French. I got it from them. And yeah, so, you know, like growing up, knowing more about France than I knew more about France than I knew about Lebanon in some way, unfortunately, because of how the culture is. Like, people value a lot learning English and stuff. Also, because unfortunately, like, there aren't many opportunities in Lebanon, so all the schools, they train people to be able to migrate in the future, because there are so much no opportunities. But I was lucky enough to be born as an Australian citizen, because during the civil war in Lebanon, that was from 75 and 90, my father migrated to Australia from Lebanon. So when I was born, it's a long story, I'm not going to get into it, but my parents divorced, so I ended up growing in Lebanon. And in a way, I'm grateful for it, because, you know, I ended up learning a lot about my culture, and yeah, in general, I value, you know, being connected to my culture in a way.
Yeah. So when did you move? Are you living in Australia at the moment?
Yes, I am. I moved here January 2019, so almost a year and a half ago. And I did it mainly because the economy in Lebanon is not doing very well. And now I came at the right time, because this year it experienced a huge crisis.
Mm.
And all this coronavirus thing didn't make it better. Like, now it's not doing very well. So I was lucky that I moved at the right time here.
Yeah. And
I just want to add that, like, yeah. But I do my best here to, like, I met a few musicians who play like various Arabic instruments and other world instruments. And, you know, it's nice. It's an opportunity for me also to discover different music genres from across the world. And it's quite fascinating. You know, it's something you can only do in Melbourne as well, I think. Like, meeting people that have so many different backgrounds. It's nice.
Thank you.
did have to give it up. I would have liked to work here also in the same field, but here it's a bit different. It's, how do you call it? Yeah, like the places where they do it here, it's a bit much bigger. There's much more competition and stuff. So I felt it was a bit, like I felt if I was going to do it, I would have had to go through an internship and all those steps. And you know, when you just move to a country, sometimes you just need money fast. So
yeah.
So it was a bit like I sure would consider it in the future, but yeah, like not right now.
Yeah. So are you able to talk about your own music, which I know you said combines classical Arabic with electronic?
It started off because electronic music is quite very popular in Lebanon, and that's the music most young people listen to. And you know, I actually started off doing electronic music much before I got into Arabic music. But then once I got into Arabic music and I started understanding it more, because the thing with Arabic music, it's not only about the instruments, like some people do. And that's why sometimes, you know, I criticize some of the fusion music, because many times it can be just doing something purely Western, using like Eastern instruments just to make it more exotic. I think, you know, like the richness of our cultural music is also within the theory, within the scales, within the logic behind it. So me and my bandmates back then, we kind of got into it a lot and we started thinking a lot. And basically we started wanting to do music that's really faithful to the Arabic system, but experimenting with sounds and with sounds that are more electronic. And what's nice about that is many people connected to it. Many, especially young people who appreciate electronic music, they really felt connected to it. And even people who are only about traditional music, like a bit older people, like they also could appreciate it as well, which is something, you know, we found happy. It's a way we were happy about, because it's a way to also like to make the two generations also be more connected with each other. As I mentioned before, I don't really like the, like, let's say someone likes electronic music, there's no point of rejecting our traditional music because of that. I think they can work hand in hand. Yeah, the project I was working on in Lebanon, it was mainly doing that. So like using synthesizer, because in Arabic music, there are what we call microtones, which are notes that are between two notes of a piano that are, I'd say, impossible to play with a regular Western instrument unless you detune it in a certain way. So what we did is we managed to program like the softwares we're using to produce music to be able to play microtones, which is interesting, because many of the sounds we play are like typical electronic sounds, but we're playing it in a familiar way for people that are like from the Middle East. And that was like, I think that's what's interesting about this, because also we're breaking the barrier of traditional being old, kind of old fashioned. And yeah, and that's what I say I'm kind of proud of, in a way.
Yeah, so have you kept the same band since moving to Australia, or has it changed since you left Lebanon?
I tried to, actually, at the beginning. But then I had a few gigs, I met a few musicians, we practiced, but I noticed that musicians here are not as connected to this kind of music. It's a different kind of connection. And I felt also it's... Yeah, like I also had lots of reflections about the music industry here. It's a bit different in some way than back in Lebanon. It's like the appreciation is kind of different, as well as like venues are a bit style specific. So when you do something a bit experimental, some venues might be scared of it. So you can't do something very specific to a culture. So here I got more, like I met with amazing musicians here from all over the world. And I'm currently working on more, like my main project I'm working on now is with an amazing sitar player called Sarita. We're doing like a combination of classical Indian and classical Arabic music.
Wow.
Because those genres are a bit inspired by each other.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
They have many similar scales and similar themes. So we're kind of working on the similarities between those two cultures and like the beauty of their differences, because even though they're similar, they have some technical differences, and we're emphasizing on those differences to make it like more beautiful in a way.
gonna take a small break to listen to another of Tara Beat's tracks. This one is called Tu Ras, and the one you had before was Kaz Dura. On what you were saying about the difference in the music community between Melbourne and Lebanon, does that mean that like there was more of an experimental space in Lebanon for a performer?
Yeah, I think here it's more because music here is an established industry. Well, in Lebanon, it's more of a way of expression, because there's no way to live off music in Lebanon. Like, no one ever thinks about it. So we use music purely to express ourselves. Well, here, you know, like, unfortunately, I met many musicians who are, like, they're amazing at their instruments. Like, I'd say, of course, musicians here are much better, like, technically more trained than musicians in Lebanon. At least many of them are. Except here, like, many musicians, they only play what they're told to play. There's not this ideology behind, like, people, I feel people here think much less about what they're doing. It's mainly about playing music more. I mean, that's my observation, at least, and I might be generalizing a bit. But in Lebanon, it's mainly a way to fight a certain social fight. And that's what I think is, like, at least in my case, I felt more of a purpose to it. Here, I feel I just have to sometimes modify my music just for it to attain a certain public, because people here are not, they don't feel the same social problems that we have in Lebanon, so they identify less with having, like, a specifically experimental genre. I don't know if that was clear.
Yeah, no, definitely. Has it been a struggle in performing to a predominantly Western audience, knowing that gap and that people here obviously haven't experienced the same things that you have, and therefore your music will be received differently? Like, is that less satisfying to be a performer?
Yeah, there are many issues with that, actually, because here all of the music that's not Western is labeled as world music, so there's no way to go deep with it in some way, which is a bit sad. And also, like, another issue would be how people perceive it as well, because people sometimes perceive everything like Eastern, or like sound exotic sounding, as being something psychedelic, something made for meditation or something like that. And I feel it doesn't really give it, like, I don't know how to say, it's not about respect, but I think, for example, once I did I performed Sufi music, and people were dancing to it as if it was like some trancy tribal music. I'm like, like, Sufi music has some religious significance for some people, and even though I'm personally not religious, I do respect those things. Yeah, that's why it's hard. Like, I cannot change the society here, obviously, but that's why, like, sometimes I just have to oversimplify what I'm doing for the sake, like, just not to, yeah, like, I'm doing what people want to hear, basically.
That sounds like a difficult position to put yourself in. Do you, like, is that a struggle as a performer, or is it something that you are willing to compromise on in order to keep playing music?
No, it's something, of course, I'm willing to compromise. I mean, I don't really have the choice, to be honest, because I made the decision to move here, and I have to assume it. No, but I mean, sometimes when we have gatherings, I have the chance, you know, to share everything I know about, like, Arabic music with people, and that's satisfying as well. Maybe we can't work on big projects like that, but also, like, sharing information is a big satisfaction as well. Like, I've been, as I mentioned before, I learned so much also recently about classical Indian music, and that's so, like, if I stayed in my bubble, I wouldn't have learned all of this. And yeah, there are some ideas that sometimes we, like, it's good to understand a bit of different cultures, because it also tells us about our culture. Like, there was lots of exchange between Indians and Arabs in the past, and that's why our music can be similar in some ways. So, you know, it's another step in my journey, I feel.
I cannot thank Camille enough for providing me with that excellent conversation and sharing his story and his work and his experiences, alongside allowing me to play this incredible collection of music from his project Tara Beat. I will put in the show notes where you can find this music, and furthermore, where you can go to look at the Arab Music Archiving and Research website. It's a huge gold mine of information, music, and artist profiles. I would thoroughly recommend checking it out. We'll go out on this last song, NT12, and I will catch you all next week. Thank you.
Thank you.